With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Despite weather challenges, there's a slight increase expected in the almond crop. California almond farmers are expected to harvest a slightly larger crop this year. That's according to a new report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The 2023 California Almond Objective Measurement Report published last week estimates the crop will come in at 2.6 billion meat pounds, 1% above last year's 2.57 billion pounds. The estimate is up 4% from USDA's subjective forecast done back in May and comes after one of the wettest winters on record, limited beef flights because of rain and wind, and a cool spring. The slightly bigger crop comes partly because of a larger nut size, USDA reports. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. The cost of transitioning to zero-emission trucks. Matt Clark, analyst for Terrain Ag, said making the transition to zero-emission trucks can be costly, but if you act now, there could be grants available to lessen the load on your wallet.
First, I guess I'll make one kind of overarching point. Traditionally, the total cost of transportation is a share of your food dollar. So like if you go buy milk for whatever a gallon it is, the percentage of that that's actually in transportation is relatively small. And that's been a big blessing for Americans, if you think about it from that side. But the big question is, that's at a macro level. When you get down to a micro level, the individual cost for a person is going to be could be a pretty large upfront cost. So I referenced some studies in this article that found that most of your traditional medium and heavy trucks, you know, there may be somewhere in that 130 to above 160,000 range, whereas most current zero emission large class trucks are somewhere around 300 to up. I'll say it that way. And it all depends on, you know, a ton of factors on how many bells and whistles you get, how big your battery storage is. The caveat that I'll add is, again, back to state money and grant money, there is quite a bit of money that's out there floating for individuals making the transition to get some incentive programs. And so if that's something that your listeners are thinking about, I would highly recommend, and I'm stressing the word highly recommend, checking through the grant programs that are out there to try to help offset that cost of both the vehicle. And then also there may be some money available out there for whatever charging unit you're putting in. So some of that is out there. And again, I would just stress if you are on the radar for going through this transition, I would highly recommend working with your local agencies to try to find some of that grant money.
Stay tuned as we'll have more from Clark on this topic later in today's interview segment. But right now, here's AgNet West's Brian German with more agriculture news.
The threat of broom rape has caused the processing tomato industry to take a much closer look at sanitation. Managing Director of the California Tomato Research Institute, Zach Bagley, said sanitation research and outreach efforts will also have benefits beyond just broom rape mitigation.
And that's not just for what growers can do independently in their own fields with their own equipment, but then what the industry can do from the trucks and trailers and shared equipment side of things like harvesters. So a lot of field days, a lot of information going out on just kind of basics of sanitation. You know, because we have that kill step, we're a processed product. We haven't had the same level of concern. Obviously, we're concerned about food safety, but sanitation hasn't been as top of mind as some other industries like leafy greens. With broom rape as this major concern, it's getting there. And yes, it's increased time, it's increased labor cost. It's another step, but this isn't just for broom rape. This is also for any soil-borne pest or pathogen. So root knot nematodes, southern blight, fungal pathogens like Fusarium wilt or Fusarium falciformi. You could benefit across all of these with the sanitation objectives and work that we have ongoing and have been reporting out to the industry.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, useless but problematic. That's how some in the cattle industry are describing an amendment to H.R. 4368, the Ag Appropriations Act. Introduced by Indiana Congresswoman Victoria Spartz, the amendment states that none of the funds made available by the bill may be used to carry out commodity checkoff programs. Vice President of Government Affairs with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Ethan Lane, says it simply wasn't necessary.
Yeah, the amendment that was offered by Representative Spartz would seek to prevent any federal funds from being used to implement federal commodity checkoff programs. But the strange thing about that is that no federal funds are used to implement federal commodity checkoff programs. They are funded by the contributions to those programs from producers throughout the country that pay in. So it really speaks to the fact that Representative Spartz and her team don't maybe understand completely the issue that they're attempting to impact with this amendment, and maybe are just kind of doing this more for media attention or whatever else, but it's not really a much of a substantive amendment.
Despite the fact that it wouldn't actually affect the checkoff funds, Lane says the amendment could add to other efforts.
Well, I think it's important in this environment where you have these radical animal rights groups and others trying to gut the checkoff system. You know, we have the OFF Act that's out there being pushed by the HSUS, Humane Society for the United States, and ASPCA, and Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey, and Mike Lee, you know, Nancy Mace. These are hardcore animal rights activist aligned folks. And so, you know, we don't want to have any sort of wrinkle in that wall of opposition to these outside forces trying to prevent from producers from promoting their own products and conducting research in the space that they operate in. So because of that alone, it's worth educating and ensuring that everyone understands what's at stake here.
He says people who don't farm likely don't know much about checkoff programs.
Well, I think amongst the consumers, there truly isn't. You know, they look at beef that's what's for dinner, or pork the other white meat, or the incredible edible egg. You know, these indelible campaigns that have been produced by various checkoff programs, and I think the vast majority of consumers have no idea of what that structure looks like that brings them that advertising. They just have that lingering knowledge of the message, right? And that's probably the best case scenario is that those consumers receive that message. But, you know, the voter side of their brain certainly is important for them to understand, you know, how these programs work. It's important for them to understand that this is not tax dollars that are going to promote these industries' products. These are producer dollars that are being overseen by USDA, but it's their dollars being managed by a board of producers from that industry directing funds to programs that are going to promote and advance those industries. So that part of it is important, that they understand that it's not their tax dollars going to this. But beyond that, you know, it really it's more that consumer side of their brain that those programs are focused on.
As of now, the vote on the Appropriations Act is not scheduled.
Well, you know, I think that we're still at this point where we're going to see, you know, how many of these are ruled in order by the Rules Committee. I think that it's entirely possible this one will either be withdrawn by Representative Spartz. We'll see whether she's willing to sort of take ownership of her miss here, or it'll be ruled out of order. I think both of those are probable. There's also the possibility that it gets through and goes to the floor. In the event that it does, I don't anticipate it receiving a tremendous amount of support.
A request for comment from Representative Spartz has not yet been returned. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, two big reports were released this past Friday by USDA. One, the biannual cattle inventory report. USDA says all cows and heifers that have calved total 38.8 million head. That's down 3% compared to July 1 of last year. The other, the monthly cattle on feed report. It shows the number of cattle and calves on feed for the slaughter market in the U.S. for feedlots with a capacity of 1,000 or more head at 11.2 million head on July 1st. That is 2% below July 1 of last year. And according to a story from Gary Crawford, it looks like the contraction in the beef cattle herd may continue for a while.
Friday's USDA twice yearly cattle inventory report has more minus signs in it.
Well, we are still in a contractionary mode.
But USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham there, and he says nothing in this new cattle report even suggests a turnaround in the continued beef herd reduction. For example,
the number of heifers being retained for beef cow replacement was down 2%. The number of beef cows in actuality was down 3%. So again, it's a smaller pool of breeding stock as of July 1st, which is definitely an indication of a delay in the expansion.
One reason for that delay?
We have very low levels of forage available for producers.
Even as pastures start to perk up after a long drought, Shagham says it's going to be the better part of a year before some of those lands will be able to support grazing. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. That inventory report notes all cows and heifers that have calved totaled 38.8 million head. That's 2% below the 39.6 million head the year before. Beef cows at 29.4 million head was down 3% from a year ago. Milk cows at 9.4 million head, really unchanged from the previous year. But they also note that 2023 calf crop is expected to be at 33.8 million head, down 2% from last year. Now, the monthly cattle on feed report shows the number of cattle and calves on feed for the slaughter market with a capacity of 1,000 head or more at 11.2 million head. And USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham has a quick look at more numbers from that report.
Number of cattle on feed gives us on July 1st a snapshot of the number of heifers and heifer calves in feedlots. And the number of heifers and heifer calves as a proportion of the total number of animals on feed on July 1st was about 39.9% of the total number of animals on feed, compared to about 39.2% a year ago. So again, we are looking at a larger proportion of heifers on feed, a smaller proportion of heifers being retained for breeding, and a smaller number of cows available. So again, we're kind of looking at a situation where it does not appear that there's an expansion.
Now, placements in feedlots during June at 1.68 million head was 3% above last year. But when it comes to marketings of fed cattle during the month of June, they were at 1.96 million head, 5% below last year. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen?
It's just nice to have local.
I listen from 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night.
I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
It keeps me up to date with everything going on in the world.
When you put the lights on in the barn, the radio went on.
It moves pretty quick so I can get the message and get on with my day.
Well, listen in the barn, skid loader, tractor, and just about anywhere you can.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The USDA is investing in urban agriculture. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. USDA announced a series of investments that will increase market access and revenue streams for producers while strengthening the food system. The investments will also give consumers better access to locally grown foods and healthier choices. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack and Deputy Secretary Soshil Torres-Small made the announcement last week in Philadelphia. Vilsack says the USDA announced 17 new urban service centers and 10 new urban county committees, as well as approximately $10.7 million in investments in farm-to-school and an expansion of Healthy Food Financing Initiative. It also includes $30 million in funding availability for the new Local and Regional Healthy Food Financing Partnerships Initiative. Torres-Small says families should have access to locally grown food wherever they live, and farmers should have profitable markets regardless of zip code. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is encouraging industry stakeholders to submit comments for and participate in a public meeting of the Federal Advisory Committee for Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production. Topics for the upcoming meeting will include addressing public comments and discussing food waste prevention and food recovery, surplus food recovery, and compostable food packing standards. The virtual meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, August 1st. The committee is part of USDA's efforts to support urban and innovative agriculture, creating a network for feedback. Members include agricultural producers and representatives from the areas of higher education or extension programs, nonprofits, business and economic development, supply chains, and financing. A link to register and participate in the August 1st meeting is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. Farmers often must deal with administrative agencies. When an agency makes a decision, appealing that decision often is to the agency. Only after exhausting administrative remedies can you get to a court. If an administrative agency makes an adverse decision, you have to go through the agency's administrative appeal process before you can go to court. The agency appeal process is often frustrating for farmers. A recent example involved a Colorado couple that bought a tract in Nebraska for recreational purposes. The land was a mess, so they spent the next 4 years removing dead trees and invasive weeds to help improve wildlife habitat and native vegetation. But a neighboring property owner complained to the EPA, which ultimately resulted in the EPA issuing a $300,000 fine for discharging pollutants into the navigable waters of the U.S. without a permit. The EPA made the judgment, levied the fine, and then sent the matter to an EPA judge whose decision would be appealed to an EPA appeals board. The farmer sued in federal court challenging the appointment of the EPA judge and the EPA's director of enforcement under the Constitution's Appointments Clause, which requires presidential appointment and Senate confirmation. The EPA backed down and withdrew its compliance order. Sometimes you have to fight fire with fire. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
How do you keep your budget in check and save for the future? AARP Oklahoma State Director Sean Voskel says AARP has tips to help rural Americans cut costs and stash savings during this time.
Unfortunately, inflation is still out there. Food costs are still rising, service providers are charging more for their labor, and surging travel has the industry raising prices to meet demand and recoup dollars lost during the pandemic. Thankfully, AARP can help you find ways to cut costs and save you money.
AARP recently published its annual 99 Ways to Save on the AARP website.
From tips to finding cheaper groceries, travel, to appliances in the scratch and dent section, there are many ways to cut costs. Some of my personal favorites would be to update your cashback credit card. It's not uncommon to get 3% back on some categories. And consider going to driving classes like AARP's Driver Safety Program, where you can land discounts on vehicle insurance. Or get a home energy audit to find out where you can better insulate your home, leading to energy savings. Find these tips and more at AARP.org.
Separately, AARP has endorsed the AM for Every Vehicle Act.
AARP understands the importance of AM radio in vehicles for our members, but especially for rural America and farmers and ranchers. Adults age 50 and above represent the largest share of AM radio listeners, but they also represent those most at risk from disaster events. AM radio is a critical element of the emergency response system and for general news and information for their local communities.
Learn more Thursday night at 9 p.m. Central Time on RFD-TV or online at aarp.org/AARP Live. Michael Clements reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
The big question on Wall Street, can the stock market make it an even dozen today? I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report brought to you by Helena Agri. 11 higher daily closes in a row on the Dow is the longest streak since February 2017. This is a heavy earnings week. That could be a factor. Estimated at 40% of the Dow companies report this week, 30% of those on the S&P 500. And of course, Federal Reserve Board meets today and tomorrow with a good chance of a quarter point rate hike before their meeting ends on Wednesday. Of interest to all consumers, energy stocks led gains yesterday after oil and gasoline futures touched three-month highs. In the grain trade, continued Russian attacks in the Danube River grain facilities and forecasts for 95 to 100-degree heat across much of the Corn Belt and Plains provides more than enough support in the grain trade. December corn, the highest since June 27th. November soybeans, September Kansas City wheat are reaching at or near contract highs. Helena technology is proven to help your fungicides and insecticides work harder. Visit HelenaAgri.com to enhance your tank mix. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
The cattle industry is speaking out against a proposed amendment to the Ag Appropriations Bill. Introduced by Indiana Congresswoman Victoria Spartz, the amendment states that none of the funds made available by the bill may be used to fund commodity checkoff programs. Vice President of Government Affairs with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Ethan Lane, says it simply wasn't necessary because none of those funds are used for checkoff programs. The programs are funded by payments from the farmers and ranchers themselves. Despite the fact that it wouldn't actually affect the checkoff funds, Lane says the amendment could add to other efforts.
We don't want to have any sort of wrinkle in that wall of opposition to these outside forces trying to prevent from producers from promoting their own products and conducting research in the space that they operate in.
As of now, the vote on the Appropriations Act is not scheduled. A request for comment from Representative Spartz has not yet been returned. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Depending on where you live, you may already have had a severe summer heat wave, a time when people say,
it's too darn hot.
So hot that it's dangerous for people to be out in it or to be stuck indoors with no air conditioning.
So if it's dangerous for people, it is usually dangerous for pets as well.
Something a pet expert says we pet owners should bear in mind. Coming up, how to protect your dog from what could be some deadly temperature situations on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford. If you haven't been living through this summer's heat wave, you for sure have heard about it.
The deadly heat and the bad air affecting close to a third of the country's population. At least 13 people, unfortunately, have died in this weather. It was hard.
During severe summer heat waves, local TV and radio stations always issue those warnings to people about the dangers of the heat and talking about how we can protect ourselves by limiting outdoor activities, staying hydrated, wearing the right clothing, or just staying inside. So that's how you keep yourself safe from heat stress and heat stroke. And of course, if you own a dog or dogs,
keeping yourself safe helps keep your pets safe too.
This from Agriculture Department veterinarian Dr. Dawn Fitzhugh. And she says it does not have to be near 100 degrees to become a serious problem for certain dogs. She says problems can start in some pets when it's 85 degrees out.
So when it gets above 85, most of the time we really want to pay attention to the heat, the humidity, and our pet's condition when they're out there.
Before taking our dogs out into the heat, Dawn says we should ask ourselves some questions.
Is our pet used to this type of heat? Are they overweight? Are they underweight? Are they older? Are they really young? So all of those things can come into play as to how our pets can tolerate the heat.
And certain breeds have more trouble in hot weather than others, and we'll get to that in a minute. But dogs in general are susceptible to heat stroke because, unlike we humans who have sweat glands all over our bodies to help cool us down,
pets, for the most part, only really perspire or sweat, like dogs and cats, through some sweat glands in their feet.
Which does not help very much. And so for dogs, their only cooling mechanism is this. Yes, panting. And for some dogs, that's not enough to keep them from becoming dangerously hot and dying from it. Don says that does happen even when the dog is accustomed to, say, 80 degrees and is okay with that.
But if you suddenly go from, say, an 80 degree temperature to now, you know, might climb up over 100 with some of these weather changes we've been seeing, that's where it's extremely dangerous.
Because some dogs just won't cut back on running and fetching and such. They just want to have fun.
And so before we know it, we can slip into something really dangerous because they're not going to limit themselves.
And that's up to us owners to limit them and watch for signs of trouble. Dawn says certain breeds are more prone to heat stroke than others.
The Alaskan Malamutes, who have that thick fur, you know, they're going to be especially vulnerable. The dogs with the little pushed-in faces that are super cute, so like your pugs and your French bulldogs, those guys are going to be especially vulnerable when it comes to heat. So we want to be really careful with some of those dogs in particular.
No matter the breed, whether it's a big dog or a little one, there are signs of trouble that we should be watching for and guarding against. If the dog is usually a big player, lots of running and jumping, or even just likes to walk really fast, but then suddenly just stops and lies down,
then that's them telling you, hey, I've had enough here.
So if you can, get that dog back indoors where it's cooler. However, let's go back a bit outside. The dog may not stop playing or walking on its own and could soon show other more serious signs of a heat problem. Suddenly slow walking, maybe staggering, trying to walk.
Perhaps even vomiting. And they can have diarrhea that can even turn to bloody diarrhea. And so those things are an emergency. So that's where you want to get your dog to an emergency veterinarian for care.
And do it as quickly as possible. Better yet, Don Fitzhugh says avoid trouble for you and your pet and spend as little time outdoors in this severe heat as possible. You've been listening to Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington.
This is the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet NewsHour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Today we have part three of my conversation with Matt Clark, an analyst with Terrain Agriculture. We're talking all about the recently mandated zero-emission truck rules set out by California and how that might have impacts on the agriculture industry nationwide. Clark conducted a study called Is the Agriculture Sector Charged for a Transportation Change? We'll give you more information on how to access this report at the end of our conversation. Got it. Here in your report, I'm looking at chart 6. It says the impact of higher transportation costs and how it won't be uniform. You sort of mentioned that a little bit, as the average consumer won't necessarily see an uptick in their, you know, price per gallon of milk or a basket of strawberries or whatever. But there's a chart here and it says hauling and freight as percentage of total production expenses. Go ahead and break that down for our listeners.
Sure. So I worked through some of the UC Davis. They do some great work on cost studies. And I use their hauling cost line item as a percentage of production costs. Typically, those are less, right? So maybe strawberries, maybe it's roughly 3%. all the way down to something like almonds, where maybe it's roughly half that. That's not to say, though, that it's an insignificant amount, because if you're making this transition, you have this large upfront cost, and then you have the cost of infrastructure around it for charging or for fueling through hydrogen, it will be at an individual level a chunk, right? It's going to be a chunk to bite. And that will be the hard part, is getting over that kind of initial hump of the transition cost, and all of the uncertainty around that will be significant. Now, again, when you look at it from a big macro picture, the percentages are relatively small. So maybe your total share of food dollar may only be like 4-ish%, or cents, on the dollar. So yeah, roughly 4%. Yeah. But again, the macro view is somewhat easier to think about than it is the micro view, where, hey, right now almonds have been tough, right? It's been a tough market. Mm-hmm. You layer on a change like this, it's going to, you know, it'll pinch people. There's no way around that. So
right, definitely.
Back to the idea of, if there's grants out there and you've got to make this transition, I would get on it quick if it were me.
Look into it.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's look at kind of the bigger picture, and you know, we've been talking specifically about almonds and milk, but this could have a bigger impact on supply chain, and we can dabble a little bit of where you're from. You know, in Kansas, there's a lot of hauling cattle for beef. And so talk to me about the supply chain in general and the impacts that this transition and these California mandated regulations will have on folks that are transporting in and out of the state.
Sure. So one of the interesting things about the California Air Resources Board, or CARB, is oftentimes they kind of set the tone for the rest of the country. And there's a number of states that historically have gone right along with CARB, or soon thereafter adopt similar type of regulations, whether that's Oregon and Washington, or whether it's, you know, maybe it's out on the East Coast. But generally, the standard is somewhat set by CARB, and years later, you start to see kind of a rollout through the rest of the country. So I live in central Kansas, to your point. I see a lot of cattle hauling. We have a lot of feedlots. We do not have a large electric grid. And I just started asking the question of, what would happen if Kansas and Nebraska had to figure this out too? Where would we be? California is at the tip of the spear, but we may only be a handful of years behind. We don't know, obviously, but mm-hmm. it's possible. And that starts to get really, really complicated. So, you know, if you think about feedlots and dairies, not all that dissimilar from California. They're normally in mm-hmm. rural areas. They're normally in areas that are smaller populations, don't have a lot of EV access at the moment. So not only is there an infrastructure cross, but there's a concern of the fact there's only a handful of packers. So mm-hmm. if you're a feedlot, you may only deal, you're, at the moment, you may have access to a number of packers, but you can't stop with the truckload of 1,400 pound cattle. You can't stop for a really long time and load up. I mean, there will be a cost to that. There's some animal welfare kind of concerns there. So that may shrink the radius in which you can operate with packers. So maybe you go from 5 packers in an easy day haul to 2. Now you have to rethink your kind of system, what you're doing, what does basis look like, what's your relationship with those packers? Because it really kind of makes it makes a larger dependency upon those. In a similar way that the Merced Dairy example played out, you have a tighter dependency on these local supply chains than you did otherwise.
Mm-hmm. How hard would that be for folks to sort of transition and rethink the way that they, you know, ship out their commodities?
Well,
is that something that is significant to their business operation, or is it maybe an easier transition and say, hey, yeah, you know, it's gonna take us a little longer, but we can make it happen? Or is it something that they really need to look at their, you know, their business plan and say, I don't know if we can make this happen?
Okay, so I'll be a rare optimist here for economists. There's very few of them, and then on the other hand, I'll be a banker previous role. So what I would say is, from the banker standpoint, man, you need to scratch these numbers carefully always for under any circumstance. Uh-huh. One thing I'm amazed with agriculture, though, is farmers are some of the most, and just my experience, not only living in a rural community, working on farms, but also just looking at things from a macro level as an economist. Farmers are some of the most, I would say, resilient and just very entrepreneurial people. They'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt that they'll figure it out, but it won't come easily.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think about my lifetime and things that have changed the industry so much. whether that's going all the way back to different regulations on diesel trucks, or whether it's things such as, you know, biofuels and how that completely changed the way that we fed animals in California. Things like that, farmers have always managed to figure out, but it's come at a good cost. And that would be kind of my view. It's going to be a challenge to rework this, think it out. It'll require partners with, whether that's your local farm bureaus or you know, if it's almonds, it's the Almond Alliance and it's the Almond Board of California, plus the producers figuring it out, as well as the haulers, shellers, processors. It's going to take a team effort to figure it out. It'll come as a group effort. But yeah, I'm generally always optimistic on farmers' ability to figure out solutions to problems.
Right. They're resilient. Yeah. As we wrap up our conversation here, what you mentioned a few of the specific findings, but if you'd like to share another highlight from this report that you found.
Yeah, I guess this is what I would highlight, just thinking about it real broadly. If you think about ag and transportation, specifically truck transportation, they are so tied together, and they've had such a long, long history of mutually kind of benefiting each other and being dependent on each other. So there was some work from the USDA that found that about 80% of all ag freight moves via truck at some point, and roughly 25% of all truck freight is somehow related to agriculture, whether that's an output or an input. So when you step back and think about it, I don't think ag was the target of this, of these rulings. I don't. But ag is going to be involved in this. And if you are, for example, a fruit and vegetable person in Salinas Valley, and you're traditionally hauling your product 350 miles to Los Angeles, hey, this is going to impact you in a pretty big way. You know, you're going to have to rethink your system. And unfortunately, for your listeners, California is kind of at the tip of the spear. They're going to be the first to really explore this. And my recommendation would be to not procrastinate on thinking through this issue. You know, make sure that your alliances, your partnerships, your organizations that you're backing, make sure that they're working on this and thinking about this critically, and that there's partnerships all along the supply chain. If we learned anything during COVID, it's that the supply chain and ag are vital to each other. And this is going to be another one of those issues that will impact both. So let's work together to figure out the answer now, as opposed to kind of waiting until 2036 or something when we're too far down the line.
Right. And scrambling and saying, oh no, what do I have to do? Yeah. If folks want to go and take a look at your report and maybe some of the other reports that you use to sort of craft this information, where can they go to get that?
Yeah. So they can go to terrainag.com, and we have you can find it there on the website. It'll be under kind of a agriculture tab. We're also on LinkedIn, and we're on Twitter and other feeds such as that under Terrain. And yeah, my information's on there too. If you're looking to contact me, by all means, I'm happy to talk through my findings with anyone, and really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it here.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. FSA County Committee nominations are due on August 1st. Farm Service Agency County Committee nominations are due on August 1st, and more than 7,700 farmers and ranchers serve on FSA County committees. They play an important role for FSA programming within their county. That's according to Lori Funderburk, a USDA Farm Service Agency State Executive Director.
A FSA County Committee is a group of farmers who are elected to serve, and the county committees help with the administration of the Farm Service Agency within the community. So they help make determinations on our programs, such as disaster assistance. They also help with hiring decisions, and they also help with outreach. So they're very valuable to us, very valuable to the operation of FSA, and it's a great way to serve your agricultural community.
Contact your local FSA office for more information.
The California Wheat Commission is optimistic that the state's wheat production will exceed expectations for wheat acres harvested for grain this year. 2023 California wheat production has benefited greatly from all the rainfall the state received, and dryland wheat is coming out strong. Some of the highlights from the crop quality reports compiled by the California Wheat Commission are that wheat yield reports indicate the state average of being more than 6,000 pounds per acre. One farmer even reported a yield of 9,500 pounds per acre with a protein content of more than 13%. Most collected hard red varieties are Summit 515 and WB9229, and most collected hard white varieties are UC Central White and UC Patwin 515. The most collected Durham variety was Mojave. Information was gathered from harvest reports received from farmers, elevators, and the collection of samples. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.